I am Farron Peterson, here interviewing Dana Zook, a retired jockey, lifelong career in the racing industry, and we are going to delve into his career path. Welcome back to the Boundless Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Farron Peterson, a professional jockey and veterinarian in Lexington, Kentucky. We are here to learn from stories of resilience, risk-taking, and perseverance. So, Dana, start with, how did you initially find your way to the racetrack and becoming a jockey?
I found my way off of a ball field where a gentleman come to me and asked me if I'd like to make a dollar getting on a horse. And I thought, yeah, I'll do that. He says, well, son, I have three horses over there on the other side here. You get in my car, and I'll take you over there, and we'll put you on each one of these horses. And he said, for a dollar a piece. And I said, yeah, heck yes. So I jumped in the car. I was a little tentative about it, but that dollar overrode that. I went over there, and then I seen this great big horse called Hitello. And I said, oh, my goodness. And I looked at him, and then he pulled this saddle out, which was a saddle I'd never saw. I saw Western saddles before, but not this type of a saddle. And he put it up on his back. And
how was this saddle different?
It was just a little flat saddle. You didn't have a horn to hold on. There was nothing other than sitting in them little stirrups.
Mm-hmm.
And different in a Western saddle, to say the least. So anyway, he threw me up on this big horse. He was at least 16 hands high. And first, let me run back. First, he gave me a little white helmet and put on my head.
Good.
And I said, well,
protected you.
Yeah. And anyway, got on the horse. He says, son, I'm going to lead you out to the track. He says, and I'm going to turn you around, and I'm going to turn you loose. And he says, you just holler at him. He'll go. And exactly what he did. He turned me around. Off he went. And we went around once. We went around twice. We went around five times before he pulled up. I said, okay. So that was a kind of something.
I thought, how many times do you think your trainer wanted you to go around?
Probably twice at the most.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, he didn't say nothing. I come back and all he said was, you done a good job. I guess because I stayed on.
That's impressive.
Yes. And then the next one was a full sister to him. Blue Through was her name, and she was a big gray, and he put me on her. And we basically did the same thing, went out there, turned around, hollered at her, off she went. Three rounds on this one, and brought her back, and then he come, and I got on the last one, which was a little mare called Neovite, and she was about 15 hands high,
a little less than,
which a little more to my size. Anyway, did the same thing with her, and he said, "Come back," and he said, "You done a good job." He says, now, how would you like to learn to be a jockey? And I, a jockey? Don't know what a jockey is. I didn't say nothing. I was just interested in that money is what I was interested in.
Do they make more than $3
yes.
a day?
So I said, okay. He said, okay. Get in my car. And he said, I'll take you back over and we'll get your bike. And I'll take you to my barn, which is only about a half mile from the little track. And that's where he took me, and he started teaching me the procedures of brushing horses and cleaning stalls and all that. And I was going to get $7 a week, which I got more than that, actually. But anyway, he said $7 a week, and that was good enough for me anyway. But every day after I got out of school, I'd get on my little bike. It was 5 miles from my little town to where the barn was. I'd ride over there, and we would get in the, I'd brush the horses, clean the stalls. He'd come in there, and we'd load him up in his truck. We'd take him over to the little small track, and same procedure that I did the first time. Got on him, galloped him, and thought that was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So then it just progresses. I kept getting a little more acclimated and understanding of the horses and so forth. Then the race meets come up, the small race meets they had there, where I'd never been in a gate, a horse gate, and they had a little small one sitting out there, and he puts me in this, first time he puts me in this gate, he says, now, he says, hold on and grab that mane with your fingers or your hand, whatever, he says, because when I swing this latch, this horse is going to leave that gate. And if you're not holding on, it's going to drop you. You're going to be out the back, and it's going to be out the front. So needless to say, I held on for dear life, and they sprung that latch, and I, wow. And I mean, I galloped them, but this, when they broke out of the gate, they were full tilt.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, I was hanging on, and didn't understand how far I was going, 3/8 or a half mile, or you know what I'm saying. But anyway, I went around the racetrack a couple of times, and she'd pulled up. I said, okay. And from there, then I started getting an idea of what was going on, mm-hmm. about racing and so forth. And then listening to him and how they went around and had these small meets and they raced. My first meet was there at Smithfield, where I rode four races on a quarter-mile racetrack. And
so just a straightaway?
No. This was around, it was a bull ring.
Bull ring quarter-mile.
Yes. Quarter-mile.
So very tight turns.
Yes, very tight turns. And thank heaven the horses I was on was very acclimated, switching their leads and taking them turns, because
mm-hmm.
I'd have been in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, rode four races, won three of the four.
Wow, 75%.
So that was special. And, of course, Doc, him and these other guys that were racing against him, they were doing side betting. And of course, it was a big thing. Doc was taking the money, and they was betting more than just a few dollars. So anyway, that's for mostly how I got started, and it went from there where I grew and got good at what I was doing, and understanding what I was doing, and learning the trade, and that's where each. Year that once I got out of school, we had the small little meets around home there in Utah. And then we would venture up to Ontario, Oregon, where I was leading rider about 5 years. I rode up there, 3 years of the five I was leading rider.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go from there back home to Utah. And then have a small meet there in a little town in Lewiston, Utah. And once that was over, then I went to Great Falls, Montana. Great Falls was a recognized racetrack, bullring.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I started my first recognized racetrack. And first year I rode there, I was leading rider.
Awesome.
And from there, then that would last 3 weeks. And then from there, I'd go to Billings, Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And I was leading rider there. Then we'd go to Kalispell, Montana, which was another 3 weeks. There's all three in sequence. I was second at Kalispell. Didn't get leading rider. Then we went to Ely, Nevada, where I was leading rider. Elko, Nevada, where I was leading rider, Blackfoot, Idaho, where I was leading rider, and Pocatello, where I was leading rider. So I was kind of the little king around there for a
while. Uh-huh. Did it get to your head?
Oh, kind of.
Uh-huh. I can't imagine you.
More
You're
than
so
anything.
Humble.
And let me run this back. When I rode them races, you were paid $5 to ride.
Okay.
$10 to win.
Mm-hmm.
Which that was good money. And then once I got to the recognized racetrack in Great Falls, Montana, then I got the percentage like you normally get of the purse structure.
Where which I is made, usually 10% to the winner,
yes,
5%
yes.
for second.
And then I rode them for quite a while. Then about the third summer after that, Doc told me, he said, we're going to Colorado, Centennial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Went up there. Never rode on a mile racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
Never been on a mile racetrack. And that's a big factor.
Yeah.
Riding on them small wall rings, and then all of a sudden, here's a
giant racetrack, wide sweeping turns.
It took me just a little bit to learn the 5/8, half mile pole, you know, so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it didn't take me long to adapt to it, to say the least. And that's where I got leading rider, not the first year, about the second year I got leading rider at Centennial. But it took off from there, and I rode there. And then I was in the process during the winter, I was going to college. I had a full scholarship at Utah State.
Wow.
Where I was for wrestling.
Really? So you were a baseball player, a wrestler,
yes,
and a jockey.
In high school, I was a wrestler. I took state 2 years in a row. That's how I got a full scholarship to college.
Because
mom, dad, they couldn't afford tuition.
Yeah.
But anyway, make the story short, I went to college for 2 years and then decided I wanted to ride. College was too much work.
Mm-hmm.
I understood riding, and I figured I could do all right making a living riding. So anyway, make a story. I jumped on an airplane and went back out east, and that's when I went to Waterford Park.
Which state was Waterford Park in?
West Virginia.
Okay.
I rode there about 6 years. And I was leading rider there.
How many times do you think?
I would say probably about 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
I rode for Dale Baird,
mm-hmm.
which was at that point in time held the most wins of any trainer in the country. Until Steve Asmussen took it from him. And I rode there for, I'd say, 6-7 years. Then I decided I was leaving there and went to Pennsylvania at Penn National.
Mm-hmm.
Never got leading rider there. I was second quite a few times. But then after 2 years of riding there, I rode for a big outfit called North American Racing. Outfit, new concepts, and they had horses in California.
Mm-hmm.
And they personally asked me to come out there and ride for them, which was at Santa Anita.
Wow.
I thought,
big time.
How about this? So off I went.
Mm-hmm.
And I rode out at Santa Anita and got to ride with all the big boys, Lafayette Pinkay, Bill Shoemaker, Angel Cordero, which the rider that impressed me out of all of them three was Lafayette Pinkay.
Why is that?
Strong, strong rider. Anyway, I rode there during the winter time. Got talked into going to Vancouver, British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I went up there, and my first year there, I was leading rider. I won 3 of their biggest stakes, their 100,000 Derby, the Queen's Plate, or Queen Elizabeth, not the Queen's Plate. The Queen's Plate was in Toronto. So I was quite happy with the way I had it. So I left there after that meeting in Vancouver, went back down to Wisconsin with my wife, and we bought a farm out there. And from there, we spent our couple months off. And I'd go back to Santa Anita, ride Santa Anita, then back to British Columbia.
Okay.
So, and I guess I should retrig a little bit on when I was at Penn National, because I did ride in New Jersey at Monmouth Park
quite a few times.
Rode at Atlantic City, which they don't no longer race, but rode there. Rode at Laurel, Pimlico.
Yeah.
Oh, and Philadelphia, Keystone, when I rode there. Now it's Parks. There's not too many racetracks I haven't rode at other than Fairgrounds is the only racetrack that I never made it to.
Wow.
So I've...
It's quite a passport.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the travel?
I did when I was, young, and it was always a challenge, to say the least. And especially when I went to California, and, you know, all of a sudden here comes a little guy from Penn National riding with Lafayette Pinquet and Bill Shoemaker and Angel Cordero.
He had some of the best riders in history.
And Chris McCarron.
It was a strong jockey colony.
And Pat Venezuela. You can just go on and on. The riders were there.
Was it discouraging to be there, or was it exciting?
No, it wasn't. I always loved the challenge.
Yeah.
He likes beating a lot of those guys. He'd tell me some of the guys that he beat when he was riding, just because he was riding the lower class horses, you know, not with the top jocks, you know what I mean? He was, he'd been some everywhere, though. He told me about when he was in California, when he moved his tech and went to California, and...
Yeah, that was a top jockey.
Yeah. And his favorite thing, and I beat him too. They beat me, but I beat them too. And he was very adamant on letting me know that, you know, he beat them also, you know what I mean?
I think that's what makes you a winner. Mm-hmm. That's what made me a winner in wrestling. I was only beat one time out of wrestling in 65 matches. And that's why I got my full scholarship to Utah State. The only thing that stopped me really from college wrestling was I weighed 110 pounds. They put me on a weight program. I just couldn't get up to 115 pounds. It hard to believe, but I couldn't. And
most jockeys struggle with the opposite problem.
And I didn't really want to downgrade my riding anyways, or, you know, lose that factor of being a rider. I want to keep that weight there. So
he was a state champion wrestler. You know, his I think his size and weight were never an issue for his riding. He was strong, you know, competitive, and a great work ethic. So and loved what he did.
That's kind of where it all went and all started.
So throughout your career, did you have to follow a certain diet, or did you always just...
No, I pretty much ate and drank what I wanted to, but I was a person that ate healthy. I wasn't an alcohol drinker by no means. I did drink occasionally, but nothing to that point. But when I rode, it was all health. I was into that and kept my... It just keeps your mind sharp when you eat right and proper. And riding especially on riding days, I would get up and have toast and a cup of coffee, and I wouldn't eat until that evening, because it keeps you on edge when I rode. And you got to be on edge. If you eat a big cheeseburger and you ride a horse.
A little lethargic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept myself on edge, and that it made me ride hard, and I did ride hard. And that's what why I won a lot of races.
Did you have a pre-race routine when you're in the room to get your mind focused?
No. I was focused from the time I stepped in that room. Let me say that. I wasn't one that had to concentrate. When I stepped in that room, it was like stepping into a ring to fight. I was in there for business, and that was to win races. And when I hit the track, I was no different. I come out of them gates, and a lot of times, I suppose people are done whatever you you know, made it tight, or whatever. But I had one thing in mind when them gates opened. That was to hit that wire first. And whatever it took, I'd usually done. Did get my number taken down a few times.
Okay, so you fouled some people.
But majority. And I always was, got the bettors would always kind of cuss me for the fact that I'd always win on horses that were 40 or 50 to 1 and stuff of that nature. And right here, in fact, when it was River Downs, they'd sit on there and they'd say, "Here comes Zook the Crook." And I didn't care. I just rode him because I wanted to win. And
didn't matter what your odds were.
No.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that carries a long ways. Why I won races I won. Because to me, I mean, I wasn't beat until I was beat, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you have that type of strong feeling on horses, they feel it. You know what I'm saying in that area.
They feel your energy, your focus. Yeah, your belief in them. Do you feel you developed that mindset from doing sports early on?
Yes. I was a winner. I hated to get beat. I did not like getting beat. When I wrestled and got beat one time, I mean, I didn't like getting beat, and that's no different racing. Which, I mean, I did get beat in racing. You're inevitable that you was going to get beat. But, I mean, that's what made me strong, and that's what made me a winner.
Yeah, absolutely. When you go back in the jocks room after a race, talk to the fans about what that's like. Everyone in there's competing against each other. We're in a field of horses. We don't have our own lanes. We're sometimes, like you said, keeping somebody tight, keeping them from getting through a hole. We're, you know, but what's it like in the room behind the scenes?
There would be times you'd come back in that room after a race and there was a lot of words said. You scolds me, or what the heck was you doing? You shut me off, so forth, so on. And that's just part of riding. You're going to get scolds. You're going to get sometimes shut off. And I'll say this. I did get in a few consultations, you might say.
Good thing you're a wrestler.
And I win a few fights, and I got whipped, too. But either way, that's part of riding in a jockey colony or in a room. There's going to be some that's not happy, and there's some that, you know, is excited because they won or whatever it may have been. There's in riding horses, a 12-horse field, there's going to be physical contact with horses and so forth. You're never going to have a smooth trip, as you know, coming out of that them gates and so forth. Horses duck in, horses duck out. You're dealing with an animal that weighs probably around 1,200 pounds, running an average of 45 miles an hour. And it's hard to control with a little 110-pound jockey that's trying to control a 1,200-pound animal. And it's not like you're sitting in a car where you can hit the brakes or turn your signal on.
No signals.
No signals. So it was, that was a lot of it, too. It was just part of racing.
And how common is it to get on a horse in a race you've never been on?
It didn't make no difference who he was or what he was. You always read your racing form and so forth and kind of glanced. I always glanced at that because all them statistics they showed with them horses, where they run prior to that and so forth, you couldn't acknowledge that. For the fact, I was a believer that every time a horse run, he would have his day and sometimes show up. And if you give him that opportunity as a rider,
then you get to win at big odds.
Yes, and you get your picture taken.
Yeah, with so much moving around you did, I'm sure you weren't with the same horses all the time.
No, no. And it was a big thing in a way. You kind of got acclimated and understood a lot of horses in the morning where you, a lot of trainers wanted you to come over and work them and so mm-hmm. forth, where you got a little idea about them.
Mm-hmm.
But on an average, I rode so many horses that I'd never seen and didn't know the trainers either.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for me, they'd tell you a little something or whatever it may be, that the horse had what he did and so forth and so on. You know, that went right throughout my ear and out the other. I rode that horse the way I wanted to ride that horse.
Mm-hmm. Just with confidence.
Yep.
Feel.
I knew what I had to do to get him to the winner's circle if he could get there.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I didn't kind of pay attention, that depended on the trainer
mm-hmm.
that I was listening to that was speaking of what the horse, as long as they told me what the horse had, a little antic or whatever, then I watched kind of for that.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I rode the horse the way I wanted to ride the horse.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the win, period.
Yeah. It seems like you picked it up quickly, your riding career, from first getting on a horse, not even knowing what a jockey is, to being leading rider multiple times in multiple tracks. Did you have a mentor besides that trainer, or a role model, or were the horses your greatest teachers?
My role model was Lafayette Pinquet.
Mm-hmm.
For the fact that when I was at Santa Anita and I sat in that room and this man would come in, and he was a big structured, if you know Lafayette Pinquet.
Built muscular,
strong and big.
Not what we
and
want
had
a jockey.
Weight trouble.
Right.
He'd come in there with a little plastic sack with a little piece of steak.
Mm-hmm.
And as the day went on, he would chew on that steak is all he'd do mm-hmm. and ride his horses. After he come out of that hot box.
Mm-hmm. So he would have sweat off several pounds already.
Yes. Uh-huh. But strength-wise, there wasn't a rider that I have saw in my time that was so strong. When you headed up that lane, I don't care if he was with you, you better ride. You better have the better horse, because you was not going to beat him. He mm-hmm. was just that strong.
Mm-hmm.
He brought the best out of horses and then some,
mm-hmm.
just on his physical aspect.
Wow.
Of course, a lot of it pertained to whipping,
mm-hmm.
which nowadays, that kind of went by the waist, or not the wayside, but it's not, you can't hit but so much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's understandable. For the horse's benefit, but no, Lafayette Pinquet.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And when you were riding at, I believe it was during Waterford, you told me once your highest number of wins on a single day.
11.
11.
That was a doubleheader now. That
you rode at two tracks? One
no, that was a doubleheader where we rode in the daytime, 7-8 races, and then at nighttime. And that was on a holiday of some nature.
Okay.
So out of the two cards, I win 11.
How did you keep your mindset focused as you got to 5, as you got to 8, as you got to 10? Did you feel you were starting to think ahead to the next race, or?
No, that's one thing I think a lot of people riders make a mistake with, is that in fact what you're saying, thinking ahead. No. When my mindset was, until it was over, it was over, and I rode them horses. I don't. When I went 3 or 4, I wasn't worried about that being the end of it. I rode that much harder to win again,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
Yeah. Now, with this successful career, you obviously enjoyed it. How did you decide when to retire, and what was your transition like?
The old story is Humpty Dumpty got put back together
mm-hmm.
several times. Dana got put back together several times.
Hmm.
I mean, I broke nothing major other than my cheekbone and my thigh where I had a pin through. Broke my ribs. I can't count.
I mean, I know one time he rolled when he had 5 broken ribs.
Wow.
Yes, he had 5 broken ribs, and he said he was fine when he get down, but he could never get up. And so he would always tell the outrider beforehand, make sure you pick me up, because they literally had to reach over there and have him sit up on the horse.
Wow.
Yeah.
Punctured my lungs. Broke my clavicles that mm-hmm. you're aware of.
How many times?
Probably about six times with them.
Okay, I'm only on one.
And my nose, I can't count the times. And the reason for your nose getting broke was when them horses would miscue out of the gate. And when they break that hard and you go down, do I have to say anything else?
Mm-mm.
That helmet would hit that nose every time. And you can see the scar across
uh-huh.
there. And I broke my cheekbone, my ankle.
Do you have a lot of hardware in you, or was it mostly just rest?
Nope, no hardware
mm-hmm.
at all. Just a lot of healed bones that's got scar tissue or whatever you want to say.
What'd you do to get back in shape?
What did I do to get back in shape?
Mm-hmm.
I'd done a lot of running.
Okay.
Really, that was my outlet, is getting toned in. I didn't go to physical places and lift weights and stuff of that nature. My main concern was my air.
Mm-hmm.
Your muscle toning comes once you start galloping horses, and that would tone me back up far strength-wise.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what was your transition? So you said Humpty Dumpty was the reason you finally retired.
Well,
although you're moving well now, and you are
still
how old now?
Good. I it was enough. In fact, the last race I won was at Beulah Park, and as I passed the wire, that horse dropped for whatever reason and broke my collarbone.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, that's it.
How old were you then?
And then I was probably around my 50, 51.
Mm-hmm. It's a long time.
And I said, that was enough. I mean, when enough's enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And I said, that's it. It was tough. Don't get me wrong. What am I going to do after that? The only thing that saved me was I did have schooling, and I went out and applied at a couple of places, and one of them was in particular was Adidas,
mm-hmm.
and that's where I went in and become a supervisor, where for 6 years I was I managed 60 people underneath me.
Mm-hmm.
And it contained me. It wasn't, I still, don't get me wrong, I still miss riding to a point, but at least it was something I could make raise my family and be comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
And thank heaven I had some good schooling.
Now, you didn't stay away from the track, though.
That was after about 7 years, then Adidas decided to move their facility from here to South Carolina, offered to move me, put me in the house. I said, no, enough's enough. So then my wife, Lissy, says, well, what are you going to do now? I went to the racetrack
mm-hmm.
and started exercising. I tell you, who asked me to start working for him was W.J. Danner.
Okay.
I said, yeah. Well, it didn't take long before Mike Maker stepped into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And when Mike asked me, I guess I missed where I did ride quite a bit for Mike.
Okay. Early on in his
before my end of my riding career.
Now, was Mike doing very well in his career yet, or was it early on?
Well, Mike was, at that point in time, was training for D. Wayne Lucas, had his string at Turfway.
Uh-huh.
And I'll say this. Mike put me on one of D. Wayne Lucas's horse in a stake at Beulah Park. Went off even money.
Mm-hmm.
I got beat. And to this day, Mike will always say, I remember that Philly Cat news.
He rode a horse for Wayne, Storm Cat filly called Cataphera Beulah Park. She was an Ohio bred, and we always give him a hard time that he got her beat and so forth. That's always fun. We remind him of that quite often.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's where that went. And I'd been with Mike for a long time, and for about 3 or 4 years. And then finally, Mike decided to venture out on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out, and I'm not sure who I started exercise or going for or riding for, exercising, I should say. But then it all come back around that I seen Mike at the races one day at Turfway, and he says, "Zookie, when you gonna come back?" And actually, I called him up the next morning. Mm-hmm. He said, "I'll see you at the barn."
Other than being a crusty old man, tell it like it is. Be the first one to the barn. You know, he's just an amazing guy. Even when we worked for Wayne, he was always the first rider there. And when he got there, he'd set the other riders tack because he was so early. And, you know, just the attitude, even to this day, that, you know, if he's not 15, 20 minutes early, and the whole morning's going to collapse. Loves what he does. I mean, at his age, still going strong. I believe he's 74, 75 years old. I've known Dana for 30 years, and hasn't changed one bit.
Mm-hmm. And but me and Mike spent a lot of years, I'd say, I've been with Mike at least going on dang near 30 years.
Uh-huh.
And just been a good mentor and a mentor, I should say, and he's just he's a trainer, and he's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not, you know, he reminds me a lot of Charlie Whittingham. Mm-hmm. I don't think at this point that I would say that there's anybody better with horses than Mike is on the grass.
Mm-hmm.
He's just good. He can pick horses out, and he's just got that good eye.
Yeah.
And he's very subtle about his business, and I thoroughly enjoyed Mike. Out of all the trainers I've worked with and rode for, Mike, yeah. Mike was like a Lafayette Pinquet to me. Is like a Lafayette mm-hmm. Pinquet to me, yeah.
And I like that he's quiet. I feel the things he says matter.
Yes.
He's never going to tell you something.
Yes.
And mean otherwise, you know, whenever he gives you a call for a horse,
yes.
He's going to be honest and follow through. Very loyal.
Well, as in riders or trainers, to be the best in whatever business you're in, you have to live it, sleep it, as the story goes.
Mm-hmm.
And as I did in wrestling, that's why I never got beat but one time. And riding, that's why I won the races I won,
mm-hmm.
was because of that factor.
Mm-hmm.
You live it, you sleep it, and I did.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing to do.
Yeah.
Not too many people can do that. But that's what makes a champion a champion.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say that.
I can see why you'd enjoy working for Mike. You want to work for people like that.
Yes.
That you, I agree. He'll drive overnight from Florida to check on his Kentucky string and then seem to be in New York the next couple days. Yeah.
Yep.
Tell him. Thought I had a great work ethic, Mike, but compared to you, I don't know. Speaking of work ethic, I do remember this winter being at Turfway Park, being in Mike's barn in the morning to breeze horses, and the other assistants were making you go home. And they said, "Dana has been sick for several days. He keeps showing up to work and wanting to help. At your age, you have plenty of accolades. You have a great boss. You could obviously take a sick day. Why don't you?"
I, you know, to me, I didn't accept the fact that if I was sick, if I was hurt, that's not an excuse not to come in and work. And I think that's what developed me and let me win the races I won and winning the matches when I wrestled. You know, sickness was secondary to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and there was times that I was sick, but I went through it. Made me who I am.
Mm-hmm. Now, having started at the racetrack at an early age, still being a major part of your life, how have you seen the racetrack change, develop for the better and for the worse?
Oh, it's no doubt that it's for the better.
Mm-hmm.
The protocol that they have with these animals are long coming that they haven't had, but up until the last couple of years that they've, where they follow and check these horses, and you have to follow protocol. And what I mean by that is take care of the horses and so forth and make sure that they're healthy to run. And it's really changed, and it's changed for the better of the interest of the horse and the interest of jockeys,
mm-hmm.
for their safety, mm-hmm. so to speak. Years back, I mean, to say the least, and I'm sure you was part of that, a lot of things was overlooked. The horse was secondary, let me say that.
Mm-hmm.
Not now.
Mm-hmm.
That horse is priority. And when you lead a horse over there, he's went through a pretty stringent protocol of through state vets that check him over very well prior to his race. And it's way it should be, or should have been. Mm-hmm. But now it is, in fact, good. It's good for the best interest of the animal, horse racing, and for jockeys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Concern.
That's great to hear.
And other than that, I mean.
Now, if you could go back and talk to young Dana, what advice would you have given yourself? You are very wise now.
Be stronger. I could have been stronger. I could have been a little more diligent and.
What, added in some weightlifting? What does that mean?
No, and just physically staying healthy, because like anything, I mean, I was a believer in that. I got off track sometimes, mm-hmm. because when you're at that age and that young and you're making that type of money,
mm-hmm.
it's very hard to stay out of the limelight, so to speak, with the crowd,
mm-hmm.
and where I got involved with the crowd, where, you know, everybody'd meet at the freaking local bar and drink and get silly and stupid and all that stuff. I could have done that a little bit better. I could have, because I was raised not to be drinking and so forth and that. And not that I was a heavy drinker, mm-hmm. by no means, but I could have done myself better and won more races if I would have followed a little stronger protocol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what makes a winner.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it, my days I got out in left field, so to speak, it probably cost me some winners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about that occasionally. So. Yeah.
I really admire your winning mindset and that you still think on those things.
Yeah. That's life.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it may be, whether it's your taking care of yourself or whatever it may be, it's that makes you a winner. If you take care of yourself and respect people and yeah.
So you kind of covered this, but what advice would you give to someone just starting out their career today, any career?
Well, give it 100%. Look up to some of the look into some of the riders that are that's won over 10,000 races, so to speak, like Perry Utes,
mm-hmm.
Russell Bays,
mm-hmm.
Willie Shoemaker, Chris McCarron. But keep yourself clean and true. Stay away from all the drugs that seem to follow a lot of people that I've saw in my life, and writers in particular. Just stay clean. And that's what makes a winner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what will make you a winner in riding races,
mm-hmm.
is just being dedicated,
mm-hmm.
and priority. Don't push your family aside, but in the business, make that number one.
Mm-hmm. You're definitely dedicated. Being around you and observing you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're a role model for sure. Well, thank you. Was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think you covered it all.
All right. Well, that was very inspiring. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
See you at the track.
Okay.
And now for a moment from our next episode with B. Buck, airing April 24th, 2025.
I am at Churchill Downs today with B. Buck. She is a freelance photographer for Churchill Downs. She has shot 6 Kentucky Derbies and 2 Breeders' Cups by the age of 38. Bea, yep. Welcome on.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Boundless is a podcast that explores the stories of individuals who have accomplished the seemingly impossible by breaking molds and redefining success through unique challenges, pivotal moments, and unbreakable determination. This episode of Boundless is brought to you by AmWager, where horse racing fans can be part of the action anytime, anywhere. Watch, wager, and enjoy races from tracks across the country on a fast, secure platform built for racing enthusiasts. Whether you're following your favorite horses or jockeys or discovering new tracks, AmWager makes it easy to stay connected to the sport you love. Getting started is simple. Sign up today at amwager.com and enjoy a 100% deposit match. Terms apply. See amwager.com for details. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, help is available. Please call 1-800-GAMBLER.